My name is Daniel Roth. I'm a senior program manager on the ASP.NET team. And we are going to do a deep dive here into ASP.NET Core. Specifically, we're going to take a deep look at ASP.NET Core MVC. I hope you're excited. It's cool stuff. I've got a lot to show you. Oh, yeah. We've got a lot of demos, and hopefully we're going to have a lot of fun. Hopefully you've all seen Scott Hunter and Scott Hanselman's talk on the introduction to ASP.NET Core. If not, I am going to do just a brief overview. We're not going to spend a lot of time on this because we want to get to demos. But ASP.NET Core is a new, and by new I mean really new, open source cross-platform framework for building modern cloud-based web applications using .NET. Okay? And new, I really mean new. In fact, it's so new that we actually recently did a rebranding. You may have heard of ASP.NET 5. That used to be what we called ASP.NET Core. And that was done in the spirit that we wanted the framework to really feel the next version. It should be comfortable and familiar. And those things are actually still very true. We designed ASP.NET Core that if you're an MVC dev, it should feel very familiar. It's just controllers and views and Razor and all those good things. But there is a lot that's new in this framework. We've completely redone the request handling pipeline. We're sitting on top of a completely new CLR, core CLR. And so because of that, we decided, it's probably the wrong message to say that this is just the old thing and then shrink-wrapped with some new features. So we decided to go with the new name. That's why we now call it ASP.NET Core. And we also gave it a V1 version. This is a new version, a new framework for building modern web applications. Why did we build ASP.NET Core? What is this framework all about? Well, first of all, we wanted something that's totally modular. Everything that we do in ASP.NET Core is done with packages. We use NuGet packages for everything. And you can pull as much into your application as you want. It's completely pay for play. Similarly, in your request handling pipeline, if you want to have like nothing in your request handling pipeline except for just the things that you need, you can do that with ASP.NET Core and get a bare metal performance. If you want everything in the kitchen sink in there so things are just really easy and productive, that's fine too. It's your choice. Because everything is NuGet packages, we have a much faster development cycle now. We can push bits to you guys much quicker. You can get features from us at a much more rapid pace. We are designing ASP.NET Core with the cloud in mind. Cloud's been around for a while now. ASP.NET was kind of before the cloud. It runs great in the cloud, but we have the benefit now of really optimizing ASP.NET Core for cloud-based scenarios. We have a new configuration system that's environment-based. It's got DI integrated into it. We're working very closely with our partners on the Azure teams to make sure that startup performance, deployment times are really fast with ASP.NET Core. ASP.NET Core is all about choice. We have a great red carpet tooling experience in Visual Studio, and we think a lot of people will love that. But if you want to get Vim open and have just a command prompt sitting there and be productive, you can do that with ASP.NET Core. We have a wonderful set of command line tools that you can just use, and actually we build our tooling on top of those same command line interfaces so that we have a consistent experience across the board, regardless of which platform you're even running on. It's open source, we accept contributions, we invite you to come and help us do contributions, that's great. We get a lot of great stuff from the community. Some of the best performance enhancements we've gotten have come from the community, and it's cross-platform, built on top of the new cross-platform .NET Core. So we run on Windows, Mac, and Linux. It's also really fast. I don't know if you saw Hunter and Hanselman's talk, but they literally put up the Power BI dashboard that our perf team internally on the product team uses to track where we're at with performance on the Tech and Power micro benchmarks. And I think they show that on the Tech and Power hardware, which is some beefy machines, that we're hitting close to 3.5 million requests per second on a micro benchmark test. And that's amazing. I can't imagine doing 3.5 million of anything in a second. So it's phenomenal. These are micro benchmarks, so don't expect that you take your big database-based app and you're going to get 3.5 million requests per second. But it at least shows you that the request pipeline is incredibly lean. It's been very optimized, which is very cool. Now, if you want to get started with our bits today, the bits that we have available today are the ASP.NET 5 RC1 bits. You can get them by going to get.asp.net. Our docs are at docs.asp.net. And of course, you can find all of our source code and samples on GitHub and our GitHub org at github.com/asp.net. The next round of bits, the ASP.NET Core branded bits, are coming soon, as soon as possible. We're working hard on them. I'll be showing some more of those bits actually later today. But for now, these are the bits that are available to you. So you may see some ASP.NET 5s in some of the demos that I'm going to show you today. Just everywhere you see that, replace that with ASP.NET Core. I'm going to talk a little bit about how ASP.NET 5 looks today and how it's changing as we move into this .NET Core, ASP.NET Core world. This is how the existing bits look. On the left, your left-hand side, you'll see there's the .NET framework at the bottom. That's the .NET framework that lives in Windows. It's a Windows component, so Windows only. On top of that, we have our ASP.NET stack, so systemweb.dll is part of the .NET framework, and we've built a variety of application frameworks on top of that. Web forms, MVC, Web API, MVC 5, Web API 2. On the right-hand side at the bottom, you see there's the new .NET Core. That's the version of .NET that's core CLR-based. It's open source. It runs cross-platform on Mac, Windows, and Linux. And then there's this layer that we call the .NET execution environment that we use in ASP.NET 5 to boot up the CLR. The CLR is just a binary, right? It's inert. It needs a process to actually get it up and going. So that's what the DNX did, and it was flexible. It could boot either the full desktop CLR or it could boot the new core CLR. So you have the option of running on either, and that's important because for compatibility, you may still want to run on the full desktop framework so that your existing binaries still work. The .NET Core has some API changes that you may need to recompile existing binaries from the work on .NET Core. If you don't have that luxury, then .NET Framework is still an option for you while the ecosystem comes forward. And it already is coming forward. We have the big players, JSON.NET, XUnit, AutoFact. These guys are already porting their libraries to work on .NET Core, and more are just coming along. And then on top of that layer, we had ASP.NET. ASP.NET 5 and with this particular branding. And then for MVC, we did the same style of branding for MVC. We called it MVC 6, so it felt like the next version of MVC. That's changing in the new world as well. We've actually decided to go with the ASP.NET Core branding for MVC so that MVC really becomes part of a unified web framework along with the rest of ASP.NET Core. So this is what ASP.NET Core looks like if you're playing around with our dev builds right now and will look like in our next pre-release. Notice that the DNX layer is gone. We no longer plan to use DNX. Instead, we get that loader, the native loader, from .NET Core itself. They have a wonderful new set of command line interface tools that we're taking advantage of, and we're working very closely with the .NET team on that new infrastructure. That's what ASP.NET Core is going to be based on. And then MVC Core, ASP.NET Core MVC is built on top of that. So that's what the new world is going to be like, okay? And you'll see some of those bits later today. What do you get in ASP.NET Core? Like, what does it give you in terms of features? You get a new hosting model. We give you a web server. We call it Kestrel. It's a managed web server. If you don't know what Kestrel is, it's a zippy little bird. Kestrel is built on top of a native component called libuv. It's the same component that Node uses for their server. We have a startup model. Startup is where you define what middleware you want in your request handling pipeline, you know, how you want your app to actually function. It's also where you configure all your services. For middleware, the middleware model in ASP.NET Core is asynchronous, and it's incredibly lightweight. We give you a whole bunch of middleware out of the box, middleware for routing, authentication, static files, diagnostics, and so forth. There's a whole bunch of them. Of course, you can write your own. Dependency injection is built into ASP.NET Core. We actually give you a little mini IOC container. It's just meant to bootstrap the system so that we can have a common abstraction that's used across all of our application frameworks, which is pretty cool. Now, if you don't want to use our IOC container, that's fine. You can easily replace it with your favorite, like AutoFact and Inject or whatever. We have a new configuration system. There is no web.config in ASP.NET Core, because there's no web.config in .NET Core. So instead, we have a really lightweight configuration model that we've introduced. It's a provider-based model. You can read from a variety of sources, including JSON files, XML files, things like environment variables, so you can do environment-based config. The whole stack is instrumented for logging, and then, of course, on the top of all that, we have our application frameworks, MVC, Identity, SignalR. We've gotten questions about SignalR. SignalR there's a repo for it. It's being built. Because of the size of the project, it got scoped out for V1, but it will come soon thereafter. So it is on the roadmap. Won't be there for V1, but will be coming soon. Quick word on what we're doing with MVC. If you look at the world today with our application frameworks in ASP.NET, we have a bunch of kind of custom-built application frameworks for a variety of needs. You have web pages for lightweight web pages, MVC for sort of testable UI, web API for building RESTful services. These frameworks are great by themselves, but they don't share a lot of code. For example, web pages and MVC, they do both use Razor, which is good, so there's some sharing there. But they have completely different HTML helpers. MVC and Web API, they look very similar. They both have controllers and actions and model bindings and filters and so forth, their own DI abstractions, but they actually share no code at all. And that there was a reason for that. When we built Web API, we wanted it to be decoupled from IIS so that you could run it in your own process. MVC was tied to System Web and hence tied to IIS, so we ended up copying a bunch of code. And that has, I think, really two bad effects. One is it causes confusion for customers. Like, you'll implement a filter, and you'll be like, why doesn't this filter work? And you'll be like, oh, I use the iFilter interface from Web API when I'm actually using MVC. Also, it's bad for us, because every time we have a feature that really should be done in both, we end up having to implement it twice, which means you get half as many features. So instead, what we want is a unified web stack. ASP.NET Core should be a unified web stack. So we're taking all these frameworks, you're unifying them into a single stack, and we're calling ASP.NET Core MVC. ASP.NET Core MVC can handle both your web UI and your web API needs. It's one set of concepts for doing both. It's built on top of ASP.NET Core, runs cross-platform just like ASP.NET Core does. You can run it in IIS. You can run the whole stack self-hosted. So we finally get self-hosted MVC applications, which is great. It has deep integration into the DI system in ASP.NET Core. And on top of all that work, you know, it took a lot of work to merge MVC and Web API and all these things together. We've also done a whole slew of new features. One of my favorites is tag helpers. Tag helpers is this really simple way to associate a piece of server-side logic with a tag in your HTML so that it can participate in the rendering of that tag. And it just makes writing Razor views a delight. And we'll see that in just a minute. In fact, that's enough talking. Let's get to some code. All right. Cool. So we're going to jump over here. And open up Visual Studio. While my computer unlocks itself. This is a very secure machine. All right, great. Phew. All right. Okay, so here what I have. I have Visual Studio 2015. I've got update 2 installed that came out this week. It's great. I've already installed the ASP.NET 5 RC1 tooling. I'm going to be using those bits. Let's go ahead and create a new ASP.NET Core project. Let's call this ASP.NET Core MVC Demo. That sounds great. Okay. I'm going to select an ASP.NET Web application. And this is going to pop up the new web app dialog. Now, at the top here, you'll see, and I apologize for the sizing. Let's see if we can, let's try to make it big so everyone can see it. Let's make it even bigger. So at the top, you'll see all the templates that are for the existing ASP.NET stack, like ASP.NET 4.5 or 4.6. This is the MVC 5 template. There's your WebForms template. Here are the new templates for ASP.NET Core. And I'm just going to create a default web application. That looks good. Now, what this is doing is this template has a whole bunch of stuff already pre-configured for you. It's got identity. It's got a whole bunch of client-side technologies like Gulp and Bower, NPM setup, so you can easily do like SPA-style patterns if you're doing a bunch of client-side work in the browser. And all these pieces are set up to be installed into the template using packages. So it's going to kick off a package restore and restore all the .NET pieces using NuGet packages and any client-side pieces that would use NPM in order to grab those. So it's restoring real quick. Now, as it restores, we can look in the Solution Explorer and see what's here. And hopefully, a lot looks very familiar. Like, I mean, still got controllers, right? And this home controller, let's open it up. That looks like any other home controller that I've seen in an MVC project. I've got index, about, contact. That looks all the same. Views, I've got Razor views. These all look the same. It's Razor, some HTML with some C# inline with that really nice, compact Razor syntax. That all looks good. Let's go ahead and run this application. I'm going to Control-F5 and pop this up. And we get, a beautifully rendered Bootstrap-styled application. It has home, about, contact. You can register new users because identity is wired up, okay? So that's how we get you started. Now, there are things that are new, though, in this that you'll notice in the Solution Explorer that are worth noting. First of all, there's this project.json file. What is that? Well, the ASP.NET Core is built on top of .NET Core, so this is a .NET Core project. And what makes it a .NET Core project is that you have a project.json file. What's in here, this is what defines like all the package dependencies for your application. That's what's in this dependency section. Now, I only need to specify the top level dependencies of my app. I don't need to specify the whole closure. .NET Core will figure that out for you when you do a restore. If I look in the references node, I can see the whole set of packages that are being referenced, nicely rendered by Visual Studio. This is a nice Visual Studio feature. I can even drill down and see the full closure of the graph from within VS. And you can search too. I don't know, some people don't know about this, but if you just type in a text, it'll actually query through the graph for you so you can find packages. So that's kind of nice. You'll notice that there were these two top-level nodes. Like, what is that about? This is currently the DNX space bit, so you're seeing DNX a little bit there. Well, with .NET Core projects, you can have a single project that is cross-compiling actually for multiple target frameworks. Like, this app is actually set up right now to cross-compile for the full .NET framework and for .NET Core, and that's specified down here in this framework section. You see that? So in the framework section, I'm saying, I want to do full framework and .NET Core for the same app. Just to, like, you might do this just to make sure that you're developing full framework, but you still want to make sure you know what things you're doing that don't work on .NET Core so you can account for that. So that's where these guys are showing up. All right, what else is new? Well, so that's what makes this a .NET Core project, but this is also an ASP.NET Core project, and that's really defined by the fact it has this startup class. Startup is what defines your ASP.NET Core application. Let me make this a little smaller so we can see it. Okay, and let's collapse. All right, so what do we have in this startup class? Well, first of all, at the bottom, something interesting. Notice there's like a program main function. Why is that there? This gets much more relevant as we move into the .NET Core world. ASP.NET Core apps really are just a console app in the .NET Core world. You literally do have a program main, and in program main is where you wire up ASP.NET hosting and get your app up and going. So that's why that's there. That becomes much more relevant, actually, as we start moving into the RC2 bits and the new .NET Core runtime. Okay, what else? Actually, to show that this is kind of like just a console app. Like right now, this app was running on IIS Express, right? I can switch this app, though, to instead run more like a console app. So I'm going to switch to this web command for the F5 gesture. Now it's going to pop up a console, and I'm getting some logging spew about what's happening in the app. Let me open up the browser again. It's saying it's listening on localhost 5000. So let's go browse there. We get some nice logging data about the actions that are being selected. You see that? That's because logging is instrumented throughout the stack. And here you see the same app now, but running as a console app. So you can run an IIS, or you can run completely self-hosted. That's totally fine. Okay, let's go ahead and stop that. So that's self-hosting of MVC. Great. What else is in this startup file? Well, there's a constructor, and that's just doing some initialization. If we look through that, this is where we're setting up configuration for this application. There's that new lightweight configuration model. There's this configuration builder type that you can add to it a bunch of configuration providers, different sources of data, of name value pairs that you might want to use in your app. This template app is set up to use just a JSON file, named appsettings.json. There's nothing special about that name. It's just what the app decided to use. Here's the appsettings.json file. You'll notice that this happens to be where the database connection string is specified, along with some logging settings. But there's some other interesting things here. Like, it's adding another configuration source, which is another JSON file, but has an environment name specified by a convention in its name. ASP.NET Core has a first-class notion of environments, an environment being something like I'm running in development, or I'm running in production, or I'm running in staging. That's a first-class notion in ASP.NET Core, and you can use that in your application. So, for example, I might have an appsettings.production.js file that has settings that are specific when I'm running in production. You can do that, and these settings are optional. That file doesn't have to exist. Also, in development, this template is set up to use configured user secrets. What is that all about? Well, one common problem that we often hear about from our developers is that they have app secrets, like your Facebook app secret that you're using for social logins, and they need a place to put it, so they throw it in config, and then they check it into source control, and then that source control maybe gets pushed to a public place or accessible place like GitHub, and now you can search through GitHub and find everyone's app secrets. That's not good, and we wanted to try and solve that problem. So the way we've done it is we've created a configuration source specifically for app secrets that live someplace else, not in your source control. We have a little tool that you can use to create, to specify app secrets values, and they get tucked away. I think it's somewhere in your user profile currently. And then this configuration provider knows how to find those secrets and use them at runtime. Okay, so that's nice, because now you've moved the secrets out of your source control so they're not, you know, accidentally getting exposed to the world. One point of confusion is this is not intended to be like a secure store for secrets. You notice that it's only even being used during development, so it's not like an encrypted password vault. It's just a way to move those secrets out of your project. Now, when you actually get into production, you might have those secrets stored in some, like, a secure store for passwords and secrets, or you might have them in environment variables that are only provisioned in your production environment. So there's even an environment variable configuration provider that you can use for this configuration source. That's what this last one is, builder.addEnvironmentVariables. And then it just sets up the config. So that's the new config model. Now let's look at configure. Configure is really the meat of your app. This is where you're setting up your request pipeline, all the middleware that you want to handle requests in your application. So let's look at what's actually in here in the default template. First, we're setting up logging. That's hence all the nice logging output. We support the debug logging and also the console logger. Again, we're seeing that environment check. If I'm in development, I want to use these sets of middleware, which are nice to have a really productive development experience. Like, I can use browser link. I get a nice exception page. If, like, an error happens at runtime and I can see it in the browser, that's convenient. We have a special error page specifically for database errors. That's helpful during development. But you would never want to publish these things to, like, production. Like, you don't want to expose the inner guts of your app through exception messages on the production site. So if I'm not running in development, then instead, we use this exception handler middleware, which catches exceptions and then forwards the request to some endpoint that you define that would like define like your oops page. You know, oh, there was something went wrong on my server. You know, we're working on it. That type of thing. In fact, and actually, you'll notice that there's a path here that's defining that endpoint, and that's just an endpoint on my home controller. I think I've actually already got home controller open. So this error action is what that middleware is routing to, and there's a view that's specific to that error action. Okay, moving down, we have some integration with IIS. Now, you don't have to run into IIS. All the stuff that you see that's IIS specific in the app is totally benign if you happen to not be running in an IIS environment. Like, if you're running on a Mac, this code still runs. Setting up static file support, setting up an identity, and finally, we get down to the bottom where we are setting up MVC. And this is where I want to spend the bulk of the time, is talking about MVC and ASP.NET Core. MVC is also middleware. It's just routing middleware, actually. In fact, if you wanted to use the routing middleware in ASP.NET Core directly, you can do that. If you do app.useRouter, and then you can specify an iRouter and do whatever you want. That is a reusable component, very similar to the way ASP.NET Routing was available to you as a reusable component in the existing stack. All this use MVC method is doing is it is calling useRouter and then setting up MVC as the default handler. Okay? Now, this is a new routing middleware. It has some really cool new features. Here's our routes that we're defining for this app. This looks like the normal default MVC route, controller action ID. But it's using this really nice compact syntax. We had it's a similar syntax that we were using for attribute routing in like Web API 2 and MVC 5. But now you can actually use it even in these conventional routes in your route table. So equal sign means, you know, default value. So the default value of the controller route value is going to be home. Question mark means optionality, that this value doesn't actually have to be there. So it's nice to compact instead of using that like anonymous object syntax that you used to have to use to specify these types of things. Okay, you can also do inline constraints. Like, you can say that this route value has to meet this constraint. Let me show you that real quick. So on my home controller, I'm going to add a quick little action. Let's call it get value. It's going to take an int ID. And then we're going to use some string interpolation here. Let's see, the value is the ID. And then let's also say whether or not the model binding was valid. So I'm going to also do model state dot is valid. Did model binding work correctly? All right. I mean, not correctly, but was the data valid? All right. And I need to return that. All right, cool. So always, you should always check model state dot is valid in an MVC app, right? You always need to do that. Okay, let's run this. Actually, I think isn't it still running? Yeah, still running. So now let's go to that action. So it was home, get value, and let's pass 1, 2, 3. Okay, Great, so there you see I'm returning that string, you know, the value that I passed in, 1, 2, 3, and the model state is valid. If I were to pass instead ABC here, you know, what's gonna happen? Well, ABC is not an int, so model binding is gonna try and take this, you know, bunch of characters and try and make it an int and be like, I can't do that. Model binding is very loosey-goosey, so it'll keep on going. It won't just stop and die, but it'll then register a model state error and let you know. So model state will no longer be valid. Let's check that that's actually the case, and yes, that's actually the case, okay? Now, if instead of that behavior, what we wanted was if I put in, you know, ABC, then I, you know, that's not even really an endpoint in my, it's not a resource in my application. I'd rather have like a 404. You can do that with routing, and we can do that with inline constraints. So on this ID, I'm gonna put a colon and say this has to be an integer. Otherwise, this route does not apply. I'm gonna save that. So now if we go back, this should still work. Like if I do 1, 2, 3, 4, there it is, that looks good. And then if I do, I don't know, CBA backwards, now I'm getting a 404 instead of, you know, some invalid model state. Okay, that's inline constraints. Another cool thing with routing is that routes now fall through. Each router has the opportunity to say when it hits, you know, did I handle this request or not? If it doesn't handle the request, the routing system will then go and try the next route. This is very relevant for MVC. Like you might hit a route, it goes into MVC and it tries to find an action method and then it doesn't find one. And it's like, ah, in the existing system, that would then result in a 404 because, you know, you already hit the route. And once you've hit a route, you're kind of done. In the new system, if that happens, like MVC can't find an action, it just says, I can't handle this request. It hops out and then the routing system will go to the next route. Let me show you that really quick. All right, so I'm gonna add another route here. Let's call this route my oops route. Okay, and for the template for this guy, I need to put some quotes. Let's say, I'm gonna do controller equals home. And then I'm gonna, for initially, just to show that this route is actually being hit, I'm gonna route it to the about action directly. Missing slash, thank you, sir. Okay, cool. So now if we go back to the app, and if we just go to like, you know, the root of the application, I expect this to go to the about page now, because it'll hit that first route and get routed to the about page. Yep, okay, that worked. Now what happens though if I were to put some action here that doesn't exist? If this was existing, the existing ASP.NET stack, you'd get a 404, because it would enter that route, and then it'd be like, I can't find an oops action, and then that would be it. In the new world, it should fall back, and then hopefully I would end at I go to the next route, which should put it to the home page. Does that make sense? So let's try that. So now if I refresh the browser after making that routing change, instead of going to about, oh, another 100 points to the helpers in the crowd. Great, and now I'm at the home page, okay? So hopefully that makes it much more flexible to set up your routes, not as quite as strict as it used to be. All right, now that's what's in the configure part of my startup class. What about this configure services method? What is that? This is the last piece of the startup logic for our ASP.NET Core application. This is where you configure all of your services. This is where you're configuring DI. All the services that you want to be injectable to the various parts of your application. You get a service collection into the configure services method, and then frameworks or your application can add whatever services you want here. For example, Entity Framework here is adding a bunch of services, including the DB context. Identity adds a bunch of services. MVC adds a bunch of services. All of the core infrastructure pieces of MVC are added as services in the container that you can then access. You can then even add application-specific services. Like here, this app is adding two services for like account confirmation or two-factor auth type scenarios, like an email sender or an SMS sender. And then these services now become available throughout the app. If you're writing custom middleware, you can inject them into your middleware. You can inject them into your controllers. Let me show you that. In the account controller, this is the thing that's handling login and those types of things. You'll notice that in the constructor, it's taking in a whole bunch of interesting services, the services that were configured in that method. So the user manager, sign-in manager, here are those two custom services that my application added, the iEmail sender and iSMS sender. And it's injecting also the logging service, so it can log stuff to the logging framework. So that's pretty cool. So you can inject stuff into your controllers. By default, the IOC container that we ship only supports injection via constructors. But if you're using your favorite IOC container, you can do property injection or whatever features that container happens to support. You can also inject services into your views. Let me show you that. If we go look at the login page, there it is. Okay, here's the login page for this application. In this view, there's the model, the login view model. And here we have this new directive, @inject. @inject is a new Razor directive. And what the way you can read what @inject is doing is the first parameter is a type of a service that you want to be made available in the page. The second parameter is a new property that you want to be defined for the page that you can then use to access that service. So this page is saying, I want a new property called sign-in manager, and it's of this service type. And so this is presumably then used just like a normal property somewhere in the page. Let's find it. And lo and behold, there it is, okay? So you can inject services into your views. Why would you want to do this? Well, there are some services that are pretty view specific. For example, we now have really nice localization story in ASP.NET Core. And one of the services we provide is an iView localizer to make it really easy to localize strings in your views. That's a view specific service. You can just inject it into your views. That's an example of that. All right, what other things are new in views? Let's see. So C# 6. Let me show you some C# 6. Let me go into the About page to do this. OK, so I'm just going to add a little bit of C# 6 code into the view itself. So var me equals me. And I'm just going to do a little string interpolation just to show that this works. So About. And notice I'm getting nice IntelliSense. You know, the Razor editor is just phenomenal. Like, they just do a really great job. OK, so that should work. So if I go to the About page now, and everything is so big, let's go to About. And then now it's saying about me as opposed to saying just about. So that's C# 6, just works. Razor pages are now also rendered asynchronously. So if you want to do asynchronous logic in your pages, in your views, in MVC, you can now do that. Like if you need to access do some I/O call or whatever, you can do that from within a view. As an example, if we look at the layout page, I think as an example of this, when it renders a partial in the layout page, you'll notice that this partial is being rendered with HTML.partialAsync instead of just HTML.partial. And you'll notice there's our new Razor syntax here for awaiting that asynchronous logic. You can now @await some asynchronous function call from within your Razor page, and that will just work, because the whole Razor pipeline is now executed asynchronously. Cool? Oh, people like that. All right, sure. Last feature I'll show in terms of views features is this view imports file. View imports is a hierarchical file. Like you put it in your folder hierarchy, and every time you have a view being rendered, it will search up the folder hierarchy looking for view imports. What it has is a collection of directives that will get included on each page. A common use for this is like your namespace declarations. Remember, there's no web.config in this world, so you can't use web.config to set up your namespace declarations for your views like you would in ASP.NET MVC 5 today. So instead, you have this view imports file, and you can use this new @using directive to set up all your namespace directives. And you get nice, you know, Razor IntelliSense for that as well, which is pretty cool. And then, of course, here in the view imports, we're also adding our tag helpers. Now, tag helpers is that cool new feature in ASP.NET Core MVC. Tag helpers, like I said before, is a way to associate a small piece of server-side rendering logic with a tag that you want to then run on the server. Here, this add tag helper directive is adding all of the built-in MVC tag helpers to this application. And those are just in a package. This is totally an opt-in feature. If you don't want to use tag helpers, you don't have to use them. But we wire them up in the template for you. If I go looking in my packages, I should see the tag helper package somewhere in here. Let's see if we can find it. There it is, MVC tag helpers. So that's the package that has all the tag helper implementations. Now, to motivate a little bit, like why do we have tag helpers and what are they for? I'm going to do a comparison that Hunter and Hansman also did, but just to really drive it home. Let me open up what the MVC 5 login page looked like. Let me go back here. Let's see. I think I have one MVC 5 default. Yes. So MVC 5 views, and let's look at the login page. Okay. Now I hate to say bad things about this code, because Razor really is very nice, right? It's a really compact way of having a mixture of C# and HTML all in one page. It's a really nice templating system. But one thing I think is an issue with this page is that it looks more like C# than it does HTML. Like, it's almost hard to tell that, oh, wait, there is some HTML sprinkled in there a little bit. That's kind of hard to read. But there's a lot of good stuff happening in this C#. Like, these HTML dot method calls, those are what we call HTML helpers in the MVC world today. And those guys do a lot of nice things for you. They have server-side logic for rendering chunks of HTML into the page. And they are very helpful for, like, rendering links and forms and so forth. But one of the problems with them is that they are, once you go into an HTML helper, you're now in a C# world. And if you want to customize the rendered output from these HTML helpers, that can be difficult. For example, let's say I just want to add an attribute to one of the rendered tags from an HTML helper. Like, I want to add a class attribute. If we look down here, like, here's this label 4. This is going to generate me a label for the email property of my model. If I just want to add a class attribute to that generated label, well, I'm in C# land, so I can't just, like, you know, put class on the generated tag. The HTML helpers do provide a syntax for doing it, which is using this anonymous object syntax, which is, you know, it's interesting. The convention is you have properties, and the name of the properties becomes the name of the attribute. The value of the property becomes the value of the attribute. Okay. The class attribute, though, well, class is a reserved word in C#. And I'm in C# land here, remember? So if I want to use it as a property name, I actually have to tell, you know, the C# compiler that, you know, treat this as an identifier. Don't treat it as the class reserved word. Unfortunately, the character that you use to do that in C# is the @ sign. Which is not confusing at all, given that the @ sign is also the character you use in Razor to toggle between HTML and C#. So, you know, that seems a little bit hard. Also, the value of this attribute is just a C# string. So I'm not going to get any IntelliSense in here from the HTML editor, which we have wonderful IntelliSense in this string, because it doesn't know about it. It's just like, I don't know what that is. That's just C#. So we think we can do better. This became really obvious that we should probably do something here when we started trying to do, like, Angular with MVC. Angular has a whole bunch of attributes that you'll want to sprinkle on your tags, and trying to do that with MVC was just too difficult. So let's compare this now with the way that login page looks like in ASP.NET Core MVC with tag helpers. Okay. Login. All right. There it is. I'm going to move this over a little bit so we get a little bit more help. First thing I hope you notice is that it looks like HTML. It's purple HTML, but it looks like HTML. Why is it purple? That purple is Visual Studio trying to tell you that there's something special. This is special HTML. There is a tag helper associated with these tags. And in fact, if I hover over these guys, I'm getting this little text box that's letting me know that, yes, this guy has a form tag helper associated with it. So some nice tooling going on here. So it looks like HTML. That's kind of nice. What else? So if we go back and look at that label, here's the label that we were looking at before. Now I just have, all I do is I define a custom attribute. This is a server-side attribute thing that is signaling that the tag helper should bind to this label tag and do something with it. And the value of this ASP-4 attribute this is now a little window into C#. If we go back to the other guy, the MVC5 version, it's as if your cursor was right after this dot. Okay? That's where it is. And if I delete this and, like, you know, control space so I get some IntelliSense, you'll see I'm getting IntelliSense on the model, because this is a little window into C#. If I just wanted to put, like, a general expression here, I can do that. I just start with an @ sign instead of, like, starting with nothing. But if you start with nothing, with this particular attribute, you will bind right at that point in the model expression, which is nice. I mean, it makes for a really nice syntax. Also, notice the class attribute is just an attribute now. If I go in here and hit space, now the HTML editor is giving me all the wonderful IntelliSense, all the bootstrap attributes that I could apply there. So that looks really good. Let me go ahead and close this guy down. I think I'm done with the MVC5 version. Now, we provide you a whole bunch of built-in tag helpers in ASP.NET Core MVC that do a whole bunch of really cool things. The form tag helper, you give it a controller and an action, and it will set up your form for you. That's really cool. We have a validation summary tag helper that you can bind to a div to say, I would like to have a validation summary somewhere here. That's great. We talked about label, input. Down here is the anchor tag helper. So instead of doing, before you would have done something like this, right? You would have done at HTML, action link, and then specify some strings for the controller and the action that you wanted to generate a link for, an anchor tag for. Now instead of doing that, by the way, you still can do that. And I know some people get a little nervous with the tag helper stuff, and they're like, oh my goodness, I'm gonna have to rewrite all my HTML helper code into tag helpers. You don't. Like all that code, the other login page, that login page actually still works as is. It's just that now you have the option of using tag helpers. So instead of using the action link HTML helper, I can just specify which action I want to generate this link for right here. That's kind of nice. What else? What other built-in tag helpers are there? If we go to the layout page, at the top of the layout page, here, instead of having a tag with a custom attribute attached to it that tells a tag helper to bind, instead we now have a completely custom tag, an environment tag. Don't go looking in the HTML5 spec for an environment tag. There isn't an environment tag. This is a tag that's defined by a tag helper. It doesn't get rendered down to the client. It's just signaling to the tag helper that you should bind here and do something with it. What does the environment tag helper do? Remember, we have that first class notion of environments in ASP.NET Core. And I never actually showed, I think, like where that comes from. It's just an environment variable. We have an environment variable that says what environment you're currently running in. If I go into the properties of this project and go to debug, down here there's this nice tooling that tells you what additional environment variables you want to run with your app. And you can see there's this hosting colon environment variable. That's what tells ASP.NET Core what environment you're running in. And of course, I'm in VS, so I'm running in development. Okay, so that's where that comes from. It's just an environment variable. But this environment tag helper, it looks at the current environment. If you're running in that current environment, then it renders its content and it removes itself. Like that environment tag disappears. If you're not running in that environment, then it doesn't render its content. Okay? So if I'm running in development, I'm going to get like the full version of these style sheets. I'm going to get the full bootstrap style sheet. If I'm running in staging or production, then I'm going to get something else. Like I'm going to use this link tag helper, and I'm going to get the stuff from a CDN, right? Because that's something you probably want to do in production. Even cooler, this link tag helper has some nice logic associated with it. It will actually test to see if the CDN is available, and you can tell it what test you want it to run, to check. And if it's not available, you can tell it what you want it to render instead. Like, use the minified version of the Bootstrap CSS file instead of the one from the CDN, okay? So that's kind of cool. That's, there's a tag helper generating custom content into your page. Down here at the bottom, similarly, we're using the environment tag helper and the script tag helper to do JavaScript. All right, what else? Cache tag helper. Show you the cache. Oh man, we're getting, time is, there's just too much to show you guys. So cache tag helper, in order to show you what the cache tag helper does, I actually want to show you a separate feature, which is called flush points. Okay, so let's imagine that you have something in your Razor view that takes a while to run. Okay, let's simulate that by putting a threading thread sleep here. Let's just sleep it for 3 seconds. Okay, so now this is the layout page, and it's going to sleep for 3 seconds at some point in the rendering. If I go and now let's run this page, 1, 2, 3, and there it is. Okay, let me make this bigger. Actually, I think I'm gonna do it on the, let's do it, is this guy still, let me stop the, no, let's do it on the self-host version. Yeah, okay, so let's get this up and running, and then let's get the F5 tools, the F12 tools up. Okay, let's look at the network and see how long that really took, and why. Okay, running, great. All right, so now let's refresh. 1, 2, 3. Okay, so there ran. Here's the actual request for that home page. And if we hover over this, IE tells us that it basically just sat there and waited for something to come back. Like nothing came back initially. Now, what if, a lot of apps, time to first byte is really important. So maybe what you want to do, because you have some part of your page that takes a while to render, maybe you want to render some of the page, send it down to the client, and then wait for the rest of it to render and send that later. Because that way you get stuff at least to the client faster. And you can do that with ASP.NET Core MVC using a flush point. And the way you do that is it's asynchronous. I mean, we're in the asynchronous world. And we call flush async right there on the page. Okay? So this will then, this should send the head with the title down to the client, and then we're going to wait 3 seconds, and then we should get the rest. So let me, just to make sure that's really happening, we're going to clear out the So then I got blank page, right? And now if I go to localhost 5000, well, notice there's why is that not, did I not save? Wait, hold on, let me, I didn't save. Okay, let's do it again. Okay, so localhost 5000, that's one. So okay, I got home page really fast that time. Let me, it's hard to see. Let me do it one more time. Localhost 5000, there, you see? You see the tab lit up like almost immediately, but I'm still waiting. And if we look at IE, IE is saying, oh, I only had to wait a little bit to get the first byte, but now I'm waiting to download the page. Okay, so that's what a flush point can do for you. You can flush some of the page down to the client while the rest of it renders. Now, no matter, Now, no matter how many times I refresh this, it's not gonna get faster. Like, it's still gonna wait that 3 seconds to render the page. But if we use the cache tag helper, and this is cool, what the cache tag helper will do is it will look at its content and it will execute the razor inside of it. And it will hold on to that rendered HTML in a server-side cache. Okay, so this is a server-side caching feature. And then the next time that page is rendered, if that cache hits, then it will stitch the rendered HTML into the page instead of re-rendering that part of the page. So if we wrap this little section in a cache tag helper, like this, okay? I saved it that time. Now let's run this page once. I would expect the first time I run this, it's gonna take 3 seconds. 1, 2, 3. Yeah, so that took 3 seconds. But now if I refresh this again, notice now we're in milliseconds, not seconds at the bottom. You see that? So that hit the cache and it didn't have to run that 3 second piece of code, whatever it was, it just took the cache content. So that's the cache tag helper. It's pretty cool, pretty fun. Now every time I show caching stuff, everyone's like, well, what can you vary it by? How do you expire the cache? And so there's a whole bunch of attributes on this thing, and you can vary by whatever you want. You can expire the cache with whatever you want. Okay, so all those options are there for you. That's the cache tag helper. Now I want to show you writing a custom tag helper really quick, because it is surprisingly easy. Like really easy to write a custom tag helper, and the tooling just works really great. Okay, so I'm gonna go to the about page, and my goal here is to write a little tag helper that can render markdown. I'm gonna type markdown into my view, and I want this tag helper to turn it into HTML. Does that make sense? Okay, so let's do that. So I'm going to add a new folder. Let's call it tag helpers. Rename. Going on. Stop. Thank you. Okay. Clicky. Okay. Let's call this tag helpers. Now this folder name is actually completely unimportant. It's just a nice place to put my tag helpers. So I'm gonna add a new item, and let's add a razor tag helper, and let's call this Markdown tag helper. Okay, and so now I have a markdown tag helper class. It derives from tag helper, that is important. This HTML target element attribute is saying what this tag helper should bind to. I'm just gonna remove that because I'm not gonna use it, because there's a nice convention with tag helpers where the tag that the tag helper will bind to just comes from the class name. So this will bind to a markdown tag. And if it was camel cased, like I had delicious meat and veggies with capital letters on each word, tag helper, then it would actually turn that, I think the official name of the casing is called the lower kebab casing. Like it would lowercase everything and put little dashes between each word, like there's a kebab skewer. It's a real thing, lower kebab casing. It will do that for you, so it looks nice in the HTML. Okay, so there, I have a tag helper. I need to add it, so I'm gonna use that add tag helper directive. And I'm gonna say I want all the tag helpers from my app. So ASP.NET Core MVC. You do have to add tag helpers from your application. And I think that's it. Okay? So I've done that. And there's a little bug with the RC1 tooling that sometimes the tooling doesn't kick in unless I close and reopen the file. So I may open this file a couple of times. That's why I'm doing that. That bug has been fixed in the RC2 builds. Now what I want is to have markdown here. And if you don't know markdown, it's like a simple way of writing HTML. Like one asterisk usually means italics, and two means bold. Okay? And I need two after it, like that. Now, let's refresh this. So let me go back to IS Express. Okay, let's close. I don't know if that's what state that guy's in. Let's do a new run, okay? And let's go to the about page. All right. Now, you'll know I'm not getting Markdown yet because I didn't implement anything, right? I just threw some tags in there and created a tag helper that didn't have any implementation. In fact, if I go view the source and I search around for Markdown, I'll find that Markdown tag. It just got spewed down. The tag helper didn't do anything with it because I didn't actually implement this process async method. So let's do that really quick. I'm going to do some async stuff in here. So I'm going to make this async. Okay. And then this output parameter represents the state of what is going to be rendered to the output. So I'm going to mutate that in order to get the behavior I want. First, I'm going to get its child content. So to get its child content, there's just a simple little method I call. This is async because the child content will literally run, execute the razor inside of the tag. So I have to do await output.get child content async. Okay. Now I want to change the content of the tag to be Markdown instead of being whatever was there before. So I'm going to do output.content.set. Now, what do I want? I actually want to set the content, but I'm already going to have rendered HTML. If I did set content here, it would actually escape things. I don't want it to escape my angle brackets and stuff. I'm going to tell it I have already nicely sanitized and ready to go HTML, so I'm going to say set HTML content, okay? Now, I need to put something in here that actually generates Markdown. There's actually a nice third-party package that does Markdown generation. It's called commonmark.net, and it already supports .NET Core, so way to go to them. So I'm going to manage NuGet packages, and I'm going to install that package from off the interwebs, commonmark.net. Yeah, there it is. Congrats to these guys. They do good work. Install. Sure. Okay, restoring my package from the internet. If the network is happy, we should be good. There, yep, okay. Now, if that worked, I should see Common Mark show up in my references. There it is, okay. And then if I go to my code, I should be able to do Common Mark. Yep, I'm already getting IntelliSense. And I need my Common Mark converter.convert. And I'm going to take the child content and get its content. And hopefully close all my parentheses. And that should be good. Okay? So now let's see if that works. That should work, right? Could it possibly work? That was way too easy. Rendering, spinny wheel of patience. Oh my goodness! That was Markdown in a page. There's two lines of code. Now, to be fair, there's one last thing to do. Like, if I actually search for Markdown in this page, I still see my Markdown tag. And that's because I didn't tell the tag helper to remove the Markdown tag. Fortunately, that's trivial to do. We just need to go in here to this code and tell the output, tag name, and set it to null. And that's the signal to say, don't render the tag. Just render the stuff that I told you to render. Okay, so if we did that, and we refresh, now that Markdown tag should be completely gone. And if I search for it, yeah, so now I'm getting a little red box saying it's not even there. Okay? Now that was cool. That was a custom tag. But what if I want to bind based off of the presence of an attribute? Like a lot of the other tag helpers we saw were doing that. You can do that. Remember that attribute we saw before, the C# attribute? It was Target element, right? So this is how you can say what element you want to target if you don't want to use the convention. I still want to target that Markdown tag, so that's fine. Now I'm also going to say HTML target element, what do I want to do here? Well, what I want is on this P tag, I want to be able to say this thing has Markdown in it just by doing that. Okay, and then let's put some Markdown in here. And let's put docs. I'll give you a link to the docs for more information, right? docs.asp.net. That looks great. Okay, so I want that to work. It's not working right now. Like, there's no purple. I want purple. So let's do P is the tag I want to bind to, but only if I have the presence of this attribute. Markdown. Okay. Well, let's see if that works. I think I have to do the control. Oh no, that's not the right button. Well, that's not my keyboard shortcut that I was using. Control F this. And this should turn purple there we go. We got some purple now. So now it's applying to that. And if I refresh the page one more time, I got a docs link. I click on the docs link. That was a Markdown link rendered in HTML. Pretty cool. So it's really easy. Okay. Wow, we still got time. Okay, more demos. So that was web UI. Let's now do web APIs, right? This is supposed to be for web APIs and web UI. Let's do both. So I'm going to do file new project. And this time, we're going to do ASP.NET Core web API. Let's do that. Demo? Sure. I don't remember if I already have that project. So I'm going to select the same template. Instead of starting with the full web application template, I'm going to start with empty, with nothing. Okay? So all this guy has in it right now is just like the server package, I think, and like an empty startup.cs. I think it's got this little like run method that will return hello world. I'm going to get rid of that too. Okay, so before when we added MVC to the project, we didn't do it, but the template had done it. It added the full MVC package, which had views and Razor and all that stuff. I'm building a web API. I don't need views. I don't need to render any HTML, at least not for the scenario I'm about to do. So for that scenario, we actually have a model for working with MVC where you can just use the core of MVC, like just the pieces that you want. So this is ASP.NET Core MVC core, really core. We are super core now. So let's grab that package, Microsoft.ASP.NET. MVC is the one you would normally use. That has everything in the kitchen sink, but we're not going to use that one because we like to be explicit about everything. We're going to use core, and I'm going to save. That kicks off a restore. All right, good. And in here, we now have that MVC core package. And when I expand this guy, there's no Razor in here. Like, you don't believe me, I know. So I'm going to search for Razor. There's no Razor. It's just like the core pieces of MVC. Now, in this world, nothing's added by default, so you have to add everything very explicitly in this model. But for web API scenarios in particular, this might be something you want to do. So let's add MVC, so app.useMVC. I'm not even going to add any routes because I'm going to use attribute routing. Attribute routing is enabled by default, and it works great for web APIs. We also need to add our services, and I'm going to do add MVC core, just the core services, not all the services. Just the core ones. Okay, now we need a web API. Let's add a folder. Oh, well, I don't even know what that did. Okay, add a folder. Let's call it controllers. You don't need to do this, but it's just a nice convention that we generally follow. And instead of, I'm just going to add a class. I'm just going to class and call it values controller. That's yes. Okay, and I'm not even going to derive from controller, the controller-based type, because you don't need to. It's a convenient thing to do because it gives you a lot of nice functionality, but you don't have to. You can use any old POCO, plain old C# object class to write a controller. And so let's add our get value action that we had before. Really simple to type, and then let's return some string interpolation thing. Value int. Okay. And is that it? Did I do that right? Okay, now we need some routing information. We need to know how to get to this type. So I'm going to add a route on the base. I need to control dot this to resolve that. Good. Okay, now to set up the base route for my controller, we're going to use a new feature that we call route tokens. I want the route for this guy just to be, slash values. It seems really repetitive, not very dry, to rewrite the name of the controller in the route. So we added a feature where you can just say, put the name of the controller here in the route definition. So route tokens are nice for defining routes without having to repeat stuff from your programming model. So this will just literally take the values and put it there for you. There's other route tokens for like the action name and the area name. So that's kind of nice, new feature. And then for the actual action, this thing's going to respond to GET requests. And here, I'm going to use curly brace syntax because I want to actually extract a value from the route from the URI using routing, which will be the ID of the request. Okay, and that's it. Let's run this guy. Okay, and the route was values, right? And a number, 1, 2, 3, 4, and there it is. Okay, that's all you need. There's no Razor. There's no nothing in here. Technically, there's not even support for JSON, actually. Like, in this model, it's really explicit. If you want a JSON formatter to output, that was just a string. If you want, a JSON formatter, you have to add it. So let's go add it. Let me do that. Okay, so Microsoft.ASP.NET.MVC formatters.JSON. Okay, that looks good. So let's add some JSON stuff to our app. This is all very explicit, so add JSON formatters. Okay, now we got some JSON. Let's do some strong typing. Let's show some content negotiation, right? We can do more than just just strings. Public class, value, prop, int ID, that looks good. And prop, string, text. Okay, then let's return, let's turn that value from here. So we'll get a new value, and we'll give its ID the ID, and the text will be the value that we had before. Okay, so now we've got at least some sort of strongly typed thing. And then let's have ability to actually post actions, post values, so post, HTTP post, and let's just, yeah, just do it to the root. And we're going to do public I action result, post value. And it's going to take a from the body. This is important. From the body, we want to have a value. And then we're going to return a 201 to say that you created a new resource. And we'll give you a location header, too, to tell you where it was created. We have a nice action result that does all that. So return new created at action result. Okay, and this guy's going to take in the action name that to help set up the location header. You have to tell it what routes you want to use to want it to generate. So the action name is going to be get value. The controller name is going to be values, right? It's the name of this controllers. And the object, route value, we need to have an ID. So we'll put, that anonymous object syntax. So ID equals, let's get the ID from here. Okay, and we'll increment it just so that we know that's actually really being called. And then for the return value, for the thing we want in the response, we'll just echo the value that came in. All right, cool. Whew. I know it's fast, but so I want to just show though content. How do we call this thing? I need to call it quickly. I could get Fiddler. I could write some HTML and some form or something. That all seems way too hard. Instead, I'm going to use a cool technology called Swagger, which is like a standardized metadata format for web APIs. And it has, along with it, kind of a pre-built help page and a test client that even comes along with it. So let's do that really quick. So I'm going to add some Swagger to my app. I'm going to use a third-party library to do that, and it's called Swashbuckle. So we're going to add some Swagger with Swashbuckle. Say that five times fast. Okay, so that's pretty quick to do. We just did this. And Swashbuckle, Swagger Gen is what generates the metadata. Swagger UI is what generates the help page thing. Okay, and I have to add those endpoints. So app.use, we gotta wait for it to restore. Is it done? Use Swagger Gen to create the endpoint for the metadata stuff, and then use Swagger UI to generate the help page. And then it relies on some additional services that I'm just gonna quickly add here. Services dot, was it add Swagger Gen, I think. Okay, that was it. So what I want to do here is I want to call that post action. I'm going to use Swagger to help me do it. Let's now go back here. Now, I happen to know that the endpoint for the Swagger UI is set up to be Swagger UI by default, so the Swagger slash UI. That was when I did that app.use Swagger UI, it sets up this endpoint for me. And if I browse to this now I'm getting this really nice visualization of the endpoints on my web API. I can see the get action. Here's the post action. It even has a little like help page thing where I can put like sample values into the request body. I can try it out. And then here's the response. In the response, I can see that location header was generated. It went to the right action with the right ID. That is just pretty awesome. Okay, so it's really easy to do. Yeah. That's all my demos. This is all the cool stuff I showed you. It was a lot. There's even more that I couldn't show you. So go to the docs and check them out. Here's some really cool sessions that you can go see to learn more about ASP.NET Core and Entity Framework Core. And come join us. Like, come read our docs. Come to our GitHub page to get some file issues. Let us know what you think. Thank you so much for coming. Yeah.